Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
Hello, everyone. You are tuned into the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast with your host Austin and
Mayu. What's going on, everyone?
Are you good? Can you start off? Can you ask me what I've been up to, please?
Yeah.
You really want to talk about yourself, right? All
right, Austin. What's going on in your life? Other than all the fame and news articles and Yahoo Finance and everything.
Yeah. So I got a couple of death threats, which is new. No, I'm joking. I got those death threats last week. It stopped this week, but. In terms of what's going on, I guess in the previous podcast, we briefly touched about me sending out about 12K, 13K flyers, me and a buddy of mine, across the Windsor region. And we're planning to send another 12 to 13K out as well. So we're going to flood the market with 25K flyers. That works out to about $5,000 to $6,000. And we're hoping to get something out of it, because if we didn't, that'd be pretty crappy. But first day it hit the market was today. So today, as in, what is it? It's Monday now? Monday. November 2nd. And when it hit the market, we actually got a couple of calls. So we have four calls today, and today's the first time it hit. Looks like we might be getting one offer in. So this one is a motivated seller who is moving to Quebec on December 2020, right? So really they only have a couple of weeks to offload. And my buddy just messaged me right now saying to check out another property and let him know my thoughts on it. So we are getting some leads, but it's just a matter of getting it at the right price, because Windsor is super saturated with mailers. However, the approach we're taking is we're going to oversaturate the market, because we noticed that a lot of wholesalers are good to put $1,000 in 1 month, but they can't keep it up consistently, right? Because wholesaling is kind of a deep pockets game to an extent. The more money you funnel into it, the more upside you'll see, but the higher risk that you're going to walk away with none of that money, right? And I think when people step away with 4 or 5K, they find it unmotivating to keep on going. But for us, we're just going to keep on funneling until we land deals. But that's pretty much the update on the wholesale side. It's only the first day. We got a couple of calls. Hopefully we'll get an offer in today. We're just waiting to hear back from the seller's wife to be on board too. And if that goes all well, then we already paid off kind of the fees and the marketing that we put in. That's everything on the wholesaling side. It's still pretty new to me, but it is going fairly well. How about you, Mayu? What you've been up to?
The last week for me was really just trying to stay ahead of all these closings. You and I, Austin, we closed a duplex together, one sale transaction that needed an extension, and my Belleville flip finally closed today, not without any hiccups, but finally I think I'm done. As long as that sale now closes at the end of this week, I will be happy camper. Took the pedal off the gas on trying to find deals in Windsor, to be honest. And I was looking at the market today because there's been a lot of, so let's talk about the Rise Facebook group for a bit, actually. So Rise is a community, and I'm assuming if you're listening to this podcast, you kind of already know that. It's a community of investors. Really, we've got monthly events. This podcast is part of that. We've also got a pretty active Facebook group now, where people are just like kind of bouncing things off one another. So one of the things that caught my eye today was someone basically made a comment that they went down to Windsor, they tried to make some offers, they were getting outbid on everything, something like 10 to 20 offers on every property. But the podcast that we just recorded with, I'll wait for you guys to hear that, but we just recorded an episode with someone from Kitchener-Waterloo where they said they've got over like 20 to 30 offers on every single property, right? So I think markets in general are hot, but I wanted to see what was going on in the Windsor market. So I started looking around within it, and there are some like low-hanging fruits where like you could buy a property, retrofit it, and like make some strategic renovations and turn it around for a decent lift in value and strong cash flows, right? Especially in those like student rental market areas. So I've just been looking at that, trying to decide if I want to jump back in and start making some offers again, or if we're going to, you know, pause for a bit. I don't know yet. I get very restless when I'm not making offers, and I'm currently at that stage in time. It's been like 2 or 3 weeks and I haven't made like a single offer. I'm kind of getting itchy.
it's that time of the month for you, eh?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I'm just like, oh, man, what am I doing? I'm not making offers.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
Yeah. But me and Austin, we both basically decided to pause on the acquisitions for a bit, try to get some things in order, and then we'll jump back into it. And it's also very turmoil time. So sometimes the best clarity is just pausing and watching.
100% agree with you, Mayu. Let's jump into today's podcast, where we have our guest, Evan Murray. And Evan is a manager at Pepsi and also a real estate agent and also a real estate investor. So he has a lot on the go. I forgot to mention he's also married. So there's obviously expectations for him to keep a happy marriage and relationship as well. So he's a super busy guy. And in this podcast, we're going to dive all into house hacking, into the Brampton real estate market, and into a bit about off-market deals as well, and managing expectations at work, because we know that's a huge sensitive topic. It's something that I guess a lot of investors with the corporate job eventually need to travel the path of navigating between their side hustle and work very carefully. So we get into that today. Hope you guys enjoy this episode. It's a fantastic one, and tune in.
All right, everyone, we're here with Evan Murray. Rather than me completely butchering his story, Evan, why don't you give everyone a nice detailed background on yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys. So I'm Evan Murray. I've got into real estate, let's say, in 2012, 2013. I started off house hacking before there was a term called house hacking. Started my research with very little knowledge, kind of learn as you go. I knew Milton was a great up-and-coming place to invest. Everyone said it was social suicide to do that, but I'm like, screw you guys, I'm gonna do it anyways. And then I just saw kind of the snowball going, where you get a, you know, home equity line of credit on that property, and then just started to get more properties as the years go on. And it's been a great way to have something when surprises happen or emergencies. I'm super passionate about it. I can talk to people. I find myself talking with coworkers a lot about it, because they have no clue about this whole world. And I'm just trying to share, you know, the knowledge, and that this is a great way for a lot of people to get out of the rat race.
That's amazing, man. Actually, let's backtrack a bit. So actually, you started looking at your first property, you said 2012, 2013.
Yes.
You were working, how old were you back then? And prior to that, like, what led you to want to, I guess, start investing? So let's dig back even a bit further about kind of the steps that took you to make your first purchase.
So I'm 33 now. So I started probably when I was 24, 25. Like a lot of us did, I read the Rich Dad Poor Dad book. I actually did a podcast, you know, didn't want to read the actual hard copy. But it was great to have that on because I was driving like an hour one way to work. So the podcast was great. I'm like, I'm going to figure out a way to stop, you know, this 9-to-5 as soon as possible. But then I'll tell you some things later about how that's not always the be all and end all. But I then started looking and seeing, okay, how much money do I have? What can I afford? Back in 2013, you know, hindsight's 2020, but I wish I bought a shit ton of properties back in 2013. There were so many homes that were in the 300,000 range in Brampton, Milton, GTA that were just fantastic furs.
That's crazy. So things have basically like three times over, like average sale price 300 to now in like 900 in those areas.
I don't like, I saw, I was helping a client probably a month ago find a property, a detached home in Milton near the GO train. It went for over $1 million and it's about 800 square feet.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
insane. And there was like 20 offers. Like, I don't know what's going on.
The exodus of Toronto.
That was a great way for me to get started. So I was like, okay, well, how do I make my first property cash flow? I don't want to really get into like a piece of shit house that needs a lot of work. I'm not comfortable with that yet. I don't know any contractors. I don't have the connections yet. I have a buddy who's a realtor. So I didn't even have my license yet. I'm like, let me just go shopping in Milton, because I just knew high level, it was outpacing the growth of the province. It had a lot of promise. It has a GO train, so a transit line.
So did you live in Milton or did you live?
I did.
Okay. So and you grew up in Milton, so you knew the ins and outs of the area, I guess?
Sorry, no, I grew up in Mississauga.
Oh, okay.
I bought it for $310, and that was like the most expensive unit. It was a townhouse condo, by the way. And then when I moved in, I just knew that I wanted to get tenants right away. I didn't know about the like tenant screening, and I got really lucky because one of the guys was a long haul truck driver, and he was in his 30s, and his parents were like, get out of the house, stop living with your parents here. You need to move out, do your own, like live your own life. And it's just so odd because they would every week would drop off laundry and food.
So they didn't really parents.
They didn't really cut him off at all. So he ended up losing his job because he drove a tractor trailer over a median. Mm. And so and in normal circumstances, if your tenant loses their job, you're not going to have some income from that rent for a while. Luckily that the parents co-signed, and if that didn't, I didn't ask for it. They just did it. And so I would have been screwed. He was just looking for more driver jobs for 6 months, knowing his license is suspended. So anyways, I lived with three guys, three kind of blue collar guys. I like to think they paid to hang out with me. It was good. It was good too, because you know, most people kind of get a little bit nervous where you buy a nice home or a home that you is an investment, and then you put people in that you may not really know, and then they trash your place, whether it's intentionally or not. They have parties or something breaks or something scratches the floor, where I'm living with these guys. So I'd be like, put your shit away, or why are you letting this, you know, these dishes just rot on the table here? Like clean up after yourself. So it actually did help me maintain the property over the 2 years I was there. And then after that, it was probably worth about $500,000. So I got a HELOC on it and then started looking in. I honestly was just thinking about what are some relatively good places to invest that can also reduce my commute to work. So at that point in time, I got another role in Brampton, and I found a place that was 10 minutes drive. I was like being very selfish in terms of like, I wanted minimal commute, but also a decent investment.
So what was the time? Like, how long did it go? How long did you take from the first one to the second one?
So 2013 was the first one, and then 2015. So I did nothing for a couple years. So right around that time, I was like, I don't like how I don't have control of. So this is right around the 2015 mark still, when after I already bought the property in Brampton, I didn't want to do condos anymore. There's definitely a time and place for that. The ability to me to make a change to a property that'll help my investment, and some other third party that doesn't care about what I'm doing can control that. I wasn't about it. So since then, after that Brampton purchase, everything since has been no longer condos.
Yeah, reason. I think you touched on something that's parking is such an underrated focus area. Like I had a property in Scarborough, and I overcommitted my parking spots without realizing it. So I told the upstairs tenants that they can have two parking spots, but they only had one car. So I was like, okay, cool, whatever. And then we finished at the basement. I was renting out the basement separately, so I had two parking spots left. And so I gave it to a basement tenant because they were willing to pay me an extra $100 for two cars. So I was like, all right, cool. It works out in my favor. And then the upstairs guys got another car, and I'm like, oh shit, like what do I do now? So then I had to basically like let them park in the backyard. It was fucked. Yeah. Okay. So that's pretty cool. So when did you become a realtor?
I became a realtor right around 2015.
Okay. So that was before your second property or after your second?
That would have been before. So I would have purchased my second property myself as a realtor.
Okay.
So it was a bit of a shit show from like, the year 2014 and 15, I was finishing up my CPA and my realtor license and working full time. So that was like,
how was that investing, getting your realtor license and working full time? I mean, for me, the biggest worry is that when I was investing, I didn't want anyone in my full time job to find out, because I didn't want anyone to think that if I messed up at work for whatever reason, it was due partially because of real estate. And they might just tell me, stop investing. Or whatever the case is.
They just judge you, right? Like, I feel like they would judge me. Like, oh, this guy's not working as hard if he has time to be investing in real estate.
And they'll foresee you on promotions. Like, if you have a bunch of assets, like, he doesn't need it. Whatever. Just keep him there.
Yeah.
100%. There's no sugarcoating that. There's definitely like that perception, and you, it's hard for people to, especially if you're like more of a senior executive that doesn't quite understand the side hustle and this is all like, this is what they do and they make great money doing that. And they don't see why someone would need to have a side hustle.
Yeah. Just cause like when they grew up or whatever era they grew up in, they didn't need the side hustle and one income was probably enough, but yeah.
Exactly. So everyone usually has somewhere where they invest their money. Some people do the stock market and they can quickly check their stocks on their phone. They don't have to go anywhere. As a real estate agent, the way that I've always told my work is I'm using it to help with my investing. So some people can do other courses and whatever to help investing in stocks or just to learn more about to make the most ROI on their money. That was my angle and that continues to be my angle with work.
I think having a good manager basically dictates the amount of time and how easy it is to dedicate it to, right? Like I've had show managers that are like younger people and like they understand exactly what you're doing and they're amazed by it or whatever. And then I've had like really uptight managers that are just like work is life and like I do nothing else other than work and I expect everyone else under me to do the exact same thing and I'm like bro, like no.
So not about it. For both of you guys, because I guess both of you guys held managerial positions, right? Being someone who's more junior, so for me when I was joining in the workforce, I was 23. I just started working, so jumping into investing was definitely something fearful. And I didn't tell anyone, right? And for obvious reasons, I didn't want to be overseen for a promotion, anything like that. Still didn't get a promotion, so I don't really give a shit.
You know.
So how would you recommend navigating as someone who's younger, right? So I guess for you guys, your bosses are directors, right? And I feel like directors are a bit more understanding at that level. But being someone who's junior, who's reporting to someone who's 27 or 28 or 29, because those are usually who the 23-year-olds would be reporting to, would you suggest being completely transparent? How would you navigate around that situation? I know Mayu was quiet on social media, so he clearly wasn't transparent, but maybe we'll get Evan's opinion because he was right off the gate. He let everyone know what he was doing.
Yeah, I would say, once again, it wasn't about saying like I want to get my license so that I can invest in real estate so I can leave this place. It's not that. It's truly about investing and making smart decisions for your investments. And this was a very easy to understand way to do that. And once again, you don't have to like absolutely broadcast this. But it is important that you probably get your manager aligned. So I was nervous. I'm not gonna lie. I was when I was a realtor in 2015, when I first got it, the first 6 months I was shitting myself. I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna get fired for having my license because this is again, but there's nothing, what are you really violating? You're still working, you're still getting your job done and you're just doing something on the side. And then the more I realized, a lot of people have side hustles. A lot of senior executives have side hustles that, you know, there's some guys that own franchises. Like
wow.
Pizzas, like Domino's pizza franchises on the side. Yeah, and they work a 9-to-5 job. So what, you know, like it's happening everywhere and good for them to have something that they're able to do instead of just go home and sit and do nothing. I just feel like, you know, you're just wasting away, not letting all of that time, not doing anything and just kind of just vegging out where, you know, so there's a lot of upside and people understand that.
So I'll give my two cents on it. I was basically quiet on social media from 2015 until the beginning of 2020. And I used to work at an accounting firm and I felt like everyone was like, either like you're very, like you're about the firm, you're trying to like climb the ladder, like, and partners expect you to be available 24/7. So then if you've got this other life of real estate investing and they know like Mayu's got like side hustles. And I heard partners literally, and like managers and senior managers say, yo, that junior associate over there has got one guy had a shoe selling company. Like he literally like bought wholesale shoes and resold it. And they're like, oh, he's got this company that does that. Like, is he really gonna work hard on our engagement? I'm like, bruh, like, come on. Like let the guy do his hustle. But but so like I heard a lot of that and as a result, like I was super quiet on social media and then this year I just kind of went, fuck it, like it happens. And then like, I still don't talk about it at work with people. Like I think part of it it's a scale issue as well, right? Like when you have X amount of properties, like it becomes pretty obvious that it is taking up a good chunk of your time. And so then if they start comparing you to other people and they like, I just feel like you get judged and it's an unnecessary headache unless you're maybe like raising capital from people at work, then I can see like an advantage to it, which I wish I leveraged a little bit more. But yeah, so there's two sides to everything. And I've definitely met a lot of associates that have a few properties and then like we just like bond like that, right? And like we have no idea, but like somehow you're like working together closely and then like it just that's comes so up like funny. They'll pick up on like a call that I'm having with my contract and they go like, what's going on there? Like what is it, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I just got this like property out somewhere that like someone's renovating for me. And then you start talking about real estate and then you bond like a whole other level at that point, right? Because you kind of, you've both been like really quiet about it.
Yeah. And it's you know how I'm sure you guys have heard this, how like, you know, money partners are everywhere and JV partners are everywhere.
Yeah.
They can be your coworkers. They could have a bunch of money. They've always wanted to invest in real estate. They know you're the real estate person. Yeah. And so they'll first like, hey, what's a burr? How do you like execute a flip? What do you like? Isn't that scary? And then you start like telling them all these examples of things that you've been doing over the years. And they're like, oh my God, you're, I know you, I trust you, I've worked with you for years. Why not put my money with you? And like,
it's so funny you say that. I literally had that exact conversation. There was, when I was a senior, I had an associate who worked under me and we were just like chill, like never really talked real estate. I wasn't that heavy in real estate at that point. And then like years go by, she left the firm, I left the firm, and then she's like following me on Instagram. She sees me posting about this stuff and she messages me and she like, we have a call. I didn't really expect anything. And she goes, okay, Mayu, like I'm ready to partner with you. And I'm like, what? Like, she's like, yeah, like I worked with you. Like, I trust you. Like, I know you, you're not some random person. And like, I'd be happy to like partner with you. I'm like, holy shit. So we covered your first two deals. How many properties are you at right now? And what does that growth trajectory look like?
Trying to go exponential. We'll see. But I've been very busy the last, I would say, 4 weeks. Those two properties I already mentioned, Milton and Brampton, I sold both. Sold Brampton earlier this year. And then I sold Milton last year. So those, and honestly, when I first, and I'm sure this is a big misconception with some people that are in real estate, is you have to buy your house and then you'd never sell it. And that's it. And you hold on to it because it's in a great neighborhood and you got it for so cheap. And that isn't necessarily the case. Sometimes you have to offload that property to get the funds to move on to something bigger. If you want to stick to the single family home game and that's your thing, then maybe you do hold on to them. But if you want to get into multifamily or duplexes, triplexes, whatever, something bigger, you do not need those single family homes anymore. You want to get fully into something bigger. So that's where I'm trying to go. I'm not there yet. I'm in the duplex world right now. I've got six properties after selling the other two. And I'm now kind of shifting gears towards me and my business partner formed a holding corp earlier this year. So purchasing and that, figuring out all the ins and outs of commercial lending and what we can do with, you know, first and second mortgages and closing with private funds. I've purchased another property in Brampton, another property in Mississauga. And then I'm very London friendly. So I've got two properties there. And now we've focused on flip in Toronto that we close in December. So we just picked that one up about a month ago. And then we picked up a place in Niagara on the Lake probably a week ago.
Is that going to be a lot of
attention? Okay. There was a lot of things you said there that I wanted
to unpack. Yeah, I want to unpack it.
Okay, so holding corp. I get this question way too often. So what is the lending? Why did you set up the holding corp? What is the lending, the commercial process for the holding corp? Do you need 2 years of active income to then borrow on to like buy properties? What's the backstory there and your experience there?
So we thought about, we first thought about, okay, what are some ways to reduce our tax obligation and also our liability? So sure, I could have put these properties in my name, but there's, and once again, like it depends on your scenario and all that. But for me, putting, you know, 6 properties in my personal name. I just need one tenant to like fall down some stairs or slip on some ice. It's game over. It's game over for me. All this work is gone. So putting into another entity that I still own, but if something was to happen, it's now a reduced liability. I wouldn't say I'm an expert yet in terms of like the whole, because we just formed it earlier this year, but the way I understand it is the commercial or the lending, the holding corp doesn't have a history at all, right? It has no run rate. It's just started. So I still have to personally guarantee it. So yeah, it's still going to affect my, you know, my lending capacity or my borrowing capacity, but the liability piece is now lowered. And then also the, there's a future runway to lower my tax obligation. And so that's why we did it. We want to get to a point where the holding corp can get pre-approved on its own and not even worry about me. Cause that's kind of last year, maybe the year before, I'm like, how am I going to get past this kind of 5 property wall? A holding corp helps with that, or, you know, JV partners where they close on the mortgage for you and all that, that also works. So that's why we started it. And then who knows what will happen, but you know, I've been working with some contractors quite a bit. And so maybe if we make them full-time employees, your tax rate can like significantly lower.
I think you need 5 full-time employees.
Yeah.
It's 5, right?
Yeah.
So
then you can get there. Yeah.
That's kind of the goal.
So, okay. So the core commercial mortgages, you're essentially just personally guaranteeing for now until you have probably 2 years of history where you can show active income and the corp can qualify on its own, right? Okay, yeah, that's kind of consistent. I think me and Austin were looking at the same thing for one of our corps, and it just becomes more complicated. So we're just like, fuck it. Like, we can still buy personally, so we might as well.
Yeah, so exactly. I actually like the point you made about the liability, because at a certain point, once you hold all of these properties personally, if you want to shift them over to the corp, you got to pay land transfer tax, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be a pretty penny. And those are things that you don't budget for, because like, you never have the intention that you're going to do that. So I like that you're doing it early on in your stage. I actually also kind of, so you mentioned a lot in that previous answer. I want to unpack some. So my, you got your turn. So now it's my turn. Okay. you're still buying deals in Brampton. Walk me through that. Like, what are the numbers looking like in a Brampton deal? Because off the top of my head, my assumption is like, there's no way we can make the numbers work in Brampton, but you clearly are. So let's hear more about that.
So Brampton, this one was more of a longer term play. So I am in that house right now. So what it was a single family home that we converted into a duplex. So the purchase price was $649, and we got I think it was like a 3.1% mortgage last year. And so call it holding costs was about, I think it was around $3,500 a month, all in. Yep. We had some money to convert the basement into a duplex. So put $25,000 into that. Now that's making $2,000 downstairs.
For how many bedrooms?
It's 2 bedrooms.
Wow. $2,000. Wow.
$2,000 for 2 bedrooms.
Basement unit. Damn.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Is this a walkout or something? Right?
It's a separate entrance basement. Yeah. It's not a walkout. There's stairs, but the stairs are outside.
$2,000 for 2 bedroom. I'm renting out a 3-bedroom basement for $1,800. Now I feel like I'm under market.
Yeah, it's I don't know if it's because it's close to the GO train. At the time, it's good. Obviously, they're working from home now. But and then we're living here right now. But the goal is that when the upstairs is 3-bedroom, so hoping to get more than that. Let's say $2,300, and so we could still pay for the utilities and still cash flow. On that. And then I'm not sure. I think Austin, you're pretty, you have some mortgages with Scotiabank, I believe.
Yeah.
But my neighbor, so just by chance, my like 3 houses down, we bought the exact same like week. on that street. And so we've been talking more and more. He wants to work with me in investing. He's got some money. It's just crazy how it just comes when you start talking about real estate with people and what you've done. But he's like, hey, have you heard about blending your interest rates? Yeah. I'm like, what's that? And so probably once again, like 6 weeks ago, I blended my interest rate to the, so you have to like further extend your mortgage 5 years. But instead of me now having a 3.1% interest rate, I now have like 2.5.
Yeah.
And so
you increased your mortgage amount, right? To blend it. And then you got a blended rate for the two mortgages together?
I didn't increase my mortgage amount at all.
Oh.
I literally just got a lower interest rate for 5 more years. So instead of me having 4 years left on my mortgage, I now fully extended 5 years, but I'm locked in at like 2.5 or 2.6. versus the paying 4 more years of 3.1.
Right. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You're reducing your mortgage payment a lot. And on top of that, you're getting more cash flow, which is ultimately what matters. Mayu, I was gonna talk to you offline. Like, that strategy is actually genius. So a lot of our mortgages are locked in 3% plus, and I can qualify for less than 2% interest rate. So I think it totally makes sense. Take advantage of this low interest rate environment. You get much more cash flow.
I did it across, so all my portfolios with Scotia. So I did, I blended them all. And I think I'm saving somewhere around like almost $2,000 to $3,000 a year in interest.
Yeah.
You had a fixed rate, like 5 year fix?
Some of them were variable, some of them were fixed, but now they're all fixed at a lower interest rate. So there's pros and cons moving to fixed, but from variable, if I know that I don't want to sell any of these. So that's, if I wanted to sell the one that was on a variable, I wouldn't have, just because of the, you know, the fees with the interest and all that. But so I want to hold onto them for the next 5 years. So I don't see any reason why I would need to do that. That's my plan right now. So we'll see.
Cool.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So it looks like your Brampton property, duplex conversion, long-term buy and hold, cash flow, a bit of a refi. And another market is Niagara on the Lake. That's another one of those markets where I'm thinking it's impossible to make anything work there, because the property prices are what? Like, they're getting close to the $1 million range there. No?
So this one's a unique one. This one was off market. This one is it's about, so 15 minutes from Fallsview. It's a 4 mile Creek, if you're aware of that area. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful neighborhood. Like, it's across the street from a winery. So there's tons of Airbnb potential here. So essentially all the homes on the street, to your point, Austin, are going for like 950, over $1 million. This one is dated. It has some like green carpet. It has like exposed like wood on the inside of the house that needs to be like redone and insulated properly. The windows all need to be redone. But we picked it up for 530.
Oh,
wow.
God. And how did that happen?
So
what?
This one is like very difficult to replicate. I'm not even gonna lie. So we know it's from another investor that is looking to kind of offload their flips. So they're like a full-time flipping, and they've got a bunch of properties that either are stagnant or they want to get money and move into a multifamily. So just the timing was right. They had about four that they were looking to wholesale, and they came to us and were like, hey, let's, what can we do here? And we have money tied up with this Toronto flip for the down payment. So we're like, how do we make this work? And it's just crazy because it's been 8 years plus in real estate investing, and I've never heard of this before, but it's called like an agreement to sale. So not an agreement of purchase and sale, it's an agreement to sale.
Okay.
And essentially what that is like you have a registered purchase agreement on the title, the seller still is on title. And in the meantime, before we close, which will be next year, we're paying them higher than their interest rate is on their mortgage. So they're making a very, very passive, you know, spread of, let's say 2%, 3%. we have rights to now work on the property and renovate it and all that. We're going to then refinance when we're done in like 4 months, pull all our money out, and then close on the deal with the excess funds we have next year. So it's, yeah, it's a crazy, it's hard.
Wait, so did you give them the down payment for now or no?
Our deposit was 10 grand.
Holy crap, dude, that's a very creative strategy. So it's called agreement to sale. And yeah, if I ask any lawyer about it, the lawyer would be
100%. Definitely go through your lawyers. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah, that's game.
Sorry, I could be agreement for sale. I'm this is how like much I'm learning about it. Like it's agreement to sale or agreement for sale, but essentially it just means that we are agreeing that in some a future date, you're going to give it to me, the property. But in the meantime, I have rights to go into the property, work on the home, pay for the utilities, pay for everything. Now, all they have is they're on title still, and they're going to be making a very, very, very passive spread on the interest rate.
Yeah, that works very well for off-market deals, I find. Obviously, you're not going to be able to negotiate that on-market because yeah, anyone can sell a house very easily nowadays. Yeah,
get out. What is that?
But yeah, off-market, that's actually a genius strategy, right? Like, if you don't have the funds to close on it now, you can give them money in the short term, so still a financial incentive, but guarantee a closing in the future.
Yeah.
And you can finish your other project. Mayu, we need to implement this in our...
What's the difference between doing that and agreement of purchase and sales with the closing date that's out 1 year?
So an agreement of purchase and sale, technically you are not allowed to go into the property at all until closing. In this one, we can go in, we can do all of our renos before closing.
Right, and it helps them get a spread as well, I guess. That would be different from the PSA as well.
Yeah, and it obviously depends on the seller's comfort zone, but and comfort level, maybe they want more.
Why would the seller do that? Like, why would they? Because they don't get their down payment back this way, and they're still holding legal liability for the mortgage. In the year, they could, in theory, just renovate it themselves and do it.
Well, but I mean, I would argue it's the same thing as asking why would a seller do a VCD? Why would they do this? Why would they do that? It's about how you negotiate it when it's, yeah, when it's off market. Sellers do some weird stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The big thing for them was they didn't have the time to work on the property anymore. They trust us. They know us. So that's a big thing. You can't just go to some seller and propose this. There's got to be some sort of foundational understanding and relationship there, which is difficult, right? You can't just, you know, meet someone and build a relationship like that overnight. But this is something that when you're in that kind of real estate, I don't want to call it a bubble or whatever environment where you're surrounded by people that are doing this, yeah, they get what you're doing, you know, and it just, you can form these, it just seems a lot more of a possibility when they're also a real estate investor.
Yeah. What happened to the other three flips? Did they already get rid of those or any agreement for sale?
I think there's a couple that are still available, so we can talk about that.
Yeah.
This is literally what it's about, guys. Deal making. Always talk about real estate. You never know when deals can fall on your plate.
Exactly.
Okay, Evan. So we do have a series of rapid fire round questions that we're going to be asking you. The first is, where will we be seeing you 5 years from now? What kind of projects? What are you going to be doing personally, work, everything?
You know what? I know we didn't touch about on this before, but I don't think I necessarily will be retired from my work just yet. We'll see. I do love what I do. But in terms of like the portfolio that I'm going to be working on, I think definitely going to be like small multifamily. I'm hoping to get into that as early as next year. And then probably have some kids. Got married this year, so that's probably going to happen soon. And yeah, so I think that's going to be what I'm going to be dabbling in. Maybe doing some coaching, see how that goes. I think, you know, around that 5 to 10 year mark, I'm going to have quite a good understanding of the tips and tricks to kind of expedite your real estate investing career. And yeah, I think just getting into the more commercial property portfolio is where I'll be.
Love it. Question number two is that if you had $10 million, if you won $10 million, what would you do with it?
I thought about this one for a bit. There's obviously 10 million directions you can go with this. But one thing that kind of has always been, this is a complete like tangent, but like I was a drama kid growing up. I was in the school play in high school, university, also in the football team. So just, you know, I was also an athlete. But one thing that I loved doing as much as I possibly could was going to the Second City downtown Toronto.
Comedy club.
So, but I would probably earmark a portion of that, you know, do some private lending, do some investing, but like open up my own version of that, because you can teach people that are, you know, nervous about speaking in front of groups and get them through improv, getting them outside of their bubble or their comfort zone, helping kids and adults that get over that fear of it's okay to, you know, and teaching them some stuff to talk to random people in a networking type environment.
I think that was a pretty unique answer. So if
you could, I also gotta say that also like that's not even like that was probably my passion project, but also I'm also really interested in like animals and making sure that there's no like puppy mills and all that. I gotta throw the charity, you know, piece out there too. I'm not just gonna everything for profit, but I do have a heart, guys. But yeah.
Yeah. All right. So if you could have dinner with one person, dead or alive, who would you choose and why?
I narrowed down to two.
One person.
Oh, God. So tough.
Ma, you said it.
I would say if it's one person, it would be Ryan Reynolds. Canadian.
I didn't expect that.
I know. So
a lot of surprises here. You're a drama student and a football athlete and a puppy dog lover and a comedian.
Ryan Reynolds has been like, he's just really inspiring to me because he's been able to absolutely crush it. I don't know. There's a lot of like, he feels like he's doing everything, a lot of things right. In an area where it's hard to do everything right. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, Evan, thank you so much for joining us today. If anyone wants to reach out to you or follow you, where could they find you at?
Probably the best way is Instagram. So EV_Murray would be my handle on Instagram. Or you can email me, Evan, EVAN.D, as in David, .Murray, @gmail.com.
And we'll have that down in the show notes. Again, thank you so much for joining us today, this morning. I know it's a long weekend. It's probably the last thing you want to do, but we definitely learned a lot. And we, guys, so we always talk about networking in this podcast, and we're going to be asking about these off-market deals when we jump off the podcast. But anyways, guys, thank you for tuning into the podcast, and remember to invest smarter and live better.